This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Brian Fernandez and Joyce Goh, with the top business stories of the day. We begin with Uber. It's announced its second quarter results. They have managed to narrow their losses by 9% to some $645 million. And net revenue is also up by 17% to $1.75 billion. If you remember, Uber's co-founder Travis Kalanick resigned recently as CEO just days before the end of the second quarter. What this seems to suggest, these financials, is that Uber has continued to make progress by narrowing its losses, even amidst the intense competition and the many scandals.
Yeah, so Sharad, you're right about that. Uber seems to be, in the midst of crisis after crisis, competition is rising, no CEO, no CFO, sexual harassment claims, and mistreatment of drivers. But it seems to be growing up as a company. So even though it is a private company, it has been releasing its financial results to news outlets every quarter. And after years of just leaking periodic results, and it's also therefore looks like it's becoming more transparent. At this point of time, it also reported that it had 8.7 billion of gross bookings, which were up 17% from the previous quarter. Now, among its biggest costs that it listed was basically India and, interestingly enough, Southeast Asia. So the numbers are improving, but they have a fight on their hands, Joyce.
Right. Actually, Uber has intensified its focus on the Southeast Asian region after Didi acquired its business in China last year. So following that sale, Uber said that it was moving its resources from China to focus here in Southeast Asia. And actually, the ride-hailing market is huge here. The potential in Southeast Asia is expected to be worth about $13.1 billion in 2025. That's more than five times the $2.5 billion USD it was worth in 2015. This is according to a study conducted by Temasek and Google. So actually, the fight here in Southeast Asia is between them and Grab.
Yes. You know, because this is great for consumers. I mean, when the big boys fight, it just means that they're going to fight for market share. They're going to lower their prices. I don't know how good this is for drivers, but it's certainly good for us who take these services.
Right.
But one of the key things with this is also it's why governments are investing in these sort of businesses. So Temasek Holdings, for example, is an investor in Grab. Quap is an investor in Uber. Now, overall, what worries me as a consumer is the fact that this is a winner-take-all strategy. The moment these two and it's a duopoly right now, essentially, across Southeast Asia, once they have pricing power, consumers will then suffer.
Right. Grab has said that it wants to champion the Southeast Asian region because it made clear from day one that this region is their home. Right. So they're like the local champion. You know, they have local knowledge to build up its product offering here. And the ASEAN battleground is fierce because, I mean, for these ride-hailing companies, because we are home to like 600 over million people. So, and everyone's using the smartphone and all that. So it's a very good market for them. And I guess can understand why they're really focusing their focus here in this region.
Can we come back to Uber now and the question of that vacant spot at the CEO? And I believe it, Brian, you just mentioned CFO position as well. There is a race and it's quite public that there's some people whose names have emerged in this race. And what do we know about that?
Well, the CEO search to replace Travis Kalanick has been ongoing. Names that have come up previously include Meg Whitman, but she's publicly now removed herself from contention.
So Meg Whitman was the CEO of Hewlett-Packard.
Yes. And now the candidates who are still in the running, interestingly enough, include General Electric's former CEO, Jeff Immelt. They're also looking for a chief financial officer after its Gautam Gupta, head of finance, left this year for startup Open Door. And he's temporarily been replaced by Prabha Adhakaran.
Okay, so that's a story to keep looking at, a race that we will inform you about as it develops. Now, back to the story that we broke earlier in this week. Joyce, when you joined us on Monday, it was your first day.
This
is day four for you. And for those who don't know, Joyce Goh has just joined us. It's just been 4 days. Now, we started with the story of merger talks on the rocks and we reached out to the two banks to find out why that evening itself half, they suspended trading on the stock, on their stocks. And the next day, there was a material announcement. And as we speculated heavily on Tuesday morning, turns out the road they were going down was an end to that merger. Now, what do we have in terms of an update now? Where do all the stakeholders in this story go?
Right. I think currently the update to this story is that the sale of ANZ, that is a shareholder in AmBank, is probably scrapped as this merger collapses. Because I think previously, I think it's known that Quap was looking at ANZ's stake in AMB, and that's about 24% in AMB. And it seems like Reuters broke the story and they said that Quap probably wants to the merged entity but not the individual banks. So ANZ's stake in AMB now, it's like off la, but who knows, right? There could be potential suitors out there.
Yes, and this is part of ANZ's broader exit out of Asia. So since Sean Elliott became a CEO last year, they have been divesting assets across the region. So they've sold their assets in China, they've sold their assets in Indonesia, they've sold their retail and wealth business to DBS Bank in October. So that's a broader strategy for them in terms of exit from Asia. But interestingly enough, Joyce, there's been market talk that the drivers for this RHB and AMB merger was not the banks themselves.
Today Star reported that this merger, there's no driver, as in like because both banks, I think from further discussions, they couldn't come to agreement with the terms. But quoting sources, Star said that there was no real party driving the deal. The only one that seemed to be in favour of and nudging the merger exercise was Bank Negara.
So taking the matrimonial metaphor really seriously at this point, think about, so it's like the godfather or maybe the parents, yes. They got together, they decided this would be a great marriage.
Match in heaven,
Those kids, well, they had other plans. You know, maybe they saw somebody in the neighbourhood they really liked. This was not really what they thought was going to be good for them. But we still really don't know the reason why this went down.
Yes.
There was still, they're still in that, and it's in the air, really, ether, as it were. The question of the contingent liabilities and the due diligence process that might have been the deal breaker.
Right. I think Star reported today that they could not agree on the valuations because there were concerns on possible contingent liabilities at AmBank and also valuations at RHB. And the Daily also said that RHB had sought legal advice on this contingent liability. But AmBank has denied this contingent liability issue. The Edge Financial Daily reported this yesterday, apparently quoting an AmBank spokesperson.
Yeah, and what did the market react to this? Basically, yesterday, the RHB Bank shares went up 6 cents, closed up, and AmBank shares closed down 18 cents.
Okay, so taking the matrimonial metaphor, so the friends, maybe they were kind of cheering on, this is not going to, you dodged a bullet there, girl, I think would be the way to put it. Now, also in the news, a Federation of Malaysian Manufacturers President Tan Sri Dato' Lim Wee Chai argues that Malaysia's GDP should be measured in USD. He said this at a conference yesterday. He said the country's GDP would have contracted rather than grown due to the ringgit devaluation. Somebody help me understand this. I would have thought that ringgit would be the natural currency in which you would put out the figures.
Well, the thing is, a lot of things, you're right. I mean, naturally, I think most countries do put their figures in their own currencies. And we've been talking about this growth story for Malaysia for a number of weeks. Our macroeconomic numbers are great. We grew 5.6% in the first quarter of 2017, 5.8% in the second quarter of 2017. Exports are up, tourism is up. But all these great numbers show a disconnect, however, because retail sales are down, consumer spending is down, car sales are down. Consumers are constantly complaining about rising prices, yet we've just released CPI numbers which show that prices only rose 3.2% in July. So there is something, the FMM perspective, the Federation of Malaysian Manufacturers perspective, really seems to be a reality check, because it really indicates that on a currency-adjusted basis, we actually have negative growth.
You know, one of the interesting conversations I had yesterday was a Grab driver who's a contractor, been in the business for 40 years. He's telling me he has to exit because he can't. There's no cash flow. He can't get. He can get jobs, but he can't get money, and that's made it untenable for him. But coming back to the, you know, this other story, which is, which way do you give in terms of denominating the GDP figures? Which would give a better, more accurate picture?
I feel it's a local currency. I don't know, because it's a gross domestic product. I mean, fine, if you want to translate that into USD, you can to compare. But a lot of the other countries, I think we've checked, we couldn't find any other countries that report GDP in USD except for the US.
And but what about the argument that Dato Lim makes? I mean, he must have. I mean, this is not a frivolous proposal, is
but,
it?
But the forex will fluctuate, right, up and down. And if you want to talk about GDP growth, let's say for this year, you don't compare that to 30 years ago. I mean, it's good if you look at local currencies, the local situation, local environment, what the economic situation is at that point in time. Not just the forex, what the currency is standing at that point in time. So there are a lot of factors. But if you look at other countries, they all report their local currency. But you can, I guess, do one that is in comparison to US, that is in comparison in USD. But I think it should still be in a local currency.
You see, I think this stems from the fact that Tan Sri Datuk Lim's point, and he's not only head of the Federation of Malaysian Manufacturers as the president, he's also one of the founder of one of our largest companies, Top Glove, which is a large exporter. And his argument is also that essentially all our positive export numbers and all that hide the fact that our competitiveness has actually not improved. The only competitiveness that has improved is vis-a-vis the currency translation, which have made our goods relatively cheaper.
Okay, we're coming up to the top of the hour in the news, but a quick update on that Twitter poll that we put out about your main form of investment. Currently, we've had quite a bit of interaction here on the Twitter poll, so if you haven't already voted, please do. Property takes 23%, 49% goes to EPF and other sort of perhaps passive forms of investing. Also 15% for shares and bonds. And for 13% of those who responded, they have investments in all. They consider them all important for themselves. Now, we're coming up, as I said, to the news bulletin. After that, we'll have the opening numbers of the stock market and more analysis for you. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.